From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Tony Harrison for Celeste Headlee. Good morning. Tupac Shakur's legacy finds a new home at Clark Atlanta University.
If you want to see, you know, who he was as a son, if you want to see who he was as an artist, if you want to see who he was as an icon and right. as a leader in the community.
That's hip-hop scholar Nzenga Burton. Much more about the new Tupac archive is ahead this hour. But first, last week we asked for your driving gripes. And yes, we hear you. Here are your first thoughts.
Hi, this is Leslie Morris in Macon. The most frightening thing I can think of is looking in your rearview mirror and seeing the grill of another car or, even worse, an 18-wheeler.
Hi, this is Rick Ballingy calling from Northeast Georgia. There's an old rule of the road that you still see posted on some signs on older highways called keep to the right except to pass. If we would just all do that, always keep to the right if nobody's to the right of us, just move to the right, there would be so much less congestion on the roads.
So we always want to know what you think. Give us a call at 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OST Talk, and you can post, of course, to Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the program. On any given day, there is probably a movie or TV crew shooting something somewhere in Georgia. But what are they making? Let's go on set in Georgia.
Here we go. Movie!
Made in Georgia!
We make films.
Movies?
Let's go to the movies.
Let's go see the stars.
Jennifer Brett is back. Jennifer is a reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. She also writes for the AJC's Atlanta Buzz blog. Jennifer, good to have you back on the program.
Good morning.
Okay, I'm gonna try to drive the cart through this segment here because there are a lot of clips to get to, a lot of movies being made here in the Atlanta and Georgia area. So let's start with Spider-Man, right?
Yes.
So Spider-Man Homecoming, that's the latest installment in this series, right?
Yeah, this is Tom Holland putting on his onesie as Robert Downey Jr.'s character disparaged him in Captain America Civil War, which is where he made his debut. This was just one of many Marvel movies to film here, mostly headquartered out of the new Pinewood Studios facility down in Fayette County. Also, they've done some filming at Screen Gems EUE. So this is the latest Marvel production coming our way. Avengers 3 and 4, Avengers Infinity War, and then Avengers whatever they call the fourth one,
right.
Are filming concurrently this summer. And literally everybody in Hollywood seems to be in Georgia. So if you manage to see Scarlett Johansson, Chris Evans, Chris Pratt, Anthony Mackie, Chadwick Boseman, Zoe Saldana, I'm running out of breath here. They are going to be here for months filming these two movies.
You want to hear a clip from the Spider-Man movie?
I do.
Let's roll it.
You're the Spider-Man from YouTube.
I'm not.
You were on the ceiling.
I wasn't. Ned, what are you doing in my room?
May let me in. You said we're going to finish a Death Star.
She doesn't know. Nobody knows. Well, I mean, Mr. Stark knows because he made my suit, but that's it.
Well, Tony Stark made you that. Are you an Avenger?
Yeah, basically.
Okay, this kid who's in this, who stars this movie, looks to be about 13, 14 years old.
Yes.
Who is he? What has he been in?
Tom Holland. Oh, my goodness. He is really a star to watch. Mm. And I actually got to watch him in action when he was filming this. This movie, of course, is set mostly in New York, and they did do some exterior shots there, but mostly it filmed here in Georgia. So I'll give you the lowdown.
Okay.
There's a scene where Tom Holland is, or Spider-Man, Peter Parker, is running down an alley, and he's, you know, getting in his spider suit. That happened down at Fairly Poplar, right behind the restaurant called Slice. If you've ever been down to downtown Atlanta and had a piece of pizza, right behind there in that alley is where that movie scene took place. Grady High School also served as a filming location for Spider-Man Homecoming, so it's always so fun to sort of try to spot Atlanta on the big screen.
So it was about a week or so ago that I started to see a bunch of clips, and maybe it was the trailer for Marvel's Black Panther.
Yes.
It was about a week or so ago that I started to see these clips.
They rolled that out during the NBA Finals,
right? That's right. Right. Let's listen to a little bit of a clip from that upcoming movie.
The Black Panther has been the protector of Wakanda for generations. A mantle passed from warrior to warrior.
Who's starring in this film?
This is Chadwick Boseman. I'm so excited to keep an eye on this white-hot, red-hot star. He has been in Georgia before. He portrayed Jackie Robinson, the great baseball hero, in 42, which filmed a little bit here and elsewhere in Georgia. He also portrayed James Brown in Get On Up. That didn't film here. It filmed in in New Orleans, the Louisiana area, but it was set largely in Georgia, of course. So I got to interview him when he was on tour promoting that one. Chadwick Boseman's Black Panther character also made its debut during Captain America: Civil War, one of the many Marvel projects to film here. And so we'll see him in his own feature film coming up.
There's another Godzilla film. We need another Godzilla film?
Apparently somebody thinks we do.
Let's listen. I don't remember that film certainly not being critically reviewed well.
You know, sometimes we'll do a remake and you just think,
why?
Where in the marketplace is anybody crying out for this?
Right, right.
A couple years ago, we had a Footloose remake that shot in Georgia and was just like terrible. But I'm sure Godzilla, King of the Beasts, is going to be marvelous.
So I've seen a bunch of clips on television because I guess this movie is going to be out in the next couple of weeks or so. This is Baby Driver. What can you tell us about that
this
film? It's a great cast. It looks like a tremendous cast.
John Hamm, Kevin Spacey, Ansel Elgort, Lily James, Isha Gonzalez. This comes out June 28th. They set this movie in Georgia and filmed it here. And so you'll definitely spot Atlanta. They filmed right around the corner from the AJC, which was so considerate of them. I was able to go and check them out for a few hours while they filmed a bank robbery scene at what used to be a bank branch right across the street from Perimeter Mall. So during the scene where Perimeter Bank, as they called it fictitiously in the movie, that happened right around Ashford Dunwoody.
So keep an eye out for that.
Yeah.
Right. So here's a clip from Baby Driver.
So what is it you do?
I'm a driver.
Oh, like a chauffeur. Anyone I'd know?
Hey, I mentioned that it's a great cast. John Hamm is in that film, and we know him from Mad Men.
Yes.
But he's become a bit of a regular around this town.
John Hamm is back right now, actually, filming a comedy called Tag about classmates who reunite for a cross-country road trip. He also filmed Million Dollar Arm here around the corner from us. They filmed a good bit at Georgia Tech, also filmed Keeping Up with the Joneses. I got an opportunity to interview him ahead of Baby Driver and learn something I didn't know about John Hamm. In college, he had a job as a daycare teacher. He was kind of on this education
path.
Oh,
get out of here. Yeah. Really?
Yeah. And so part of his, training and teaching was, serving as a daycare teacher. And he talked about really enjoying that. It was a high energy group, as you would imagine.
Yeah.
So I asked him, is there anything about working with little children that maybe prepared you for life on a movie set? And I was hoping he'd kind of say, temper tantrums on one hand and the other. But no, he was very gracious and debonair, as you would expect, and said he was just,
of course.
He loves working with children and really prizes education. In fact, he's teamed up with his high school alma mater to endow a scholarship in the name of his late mom and to christen a new Black Box Theater in honor of his drama teacher.
Well, Jennifer Brett is here from the AJC. Did you mention Bad Moms? Did you just mention Bad Moms just a second ago?
We can.
Okay, because we've got a clip from Bad Moms.
Emergency PTA meeting tonight. Tell all your friends.
Oh, I don't have any friends. I'm pretty isolated at home. I have four kids.
Okay, good. Please move along. Thank you. Emergency PTA meeting tonight.
Thank you for inviting me.
Oh my gosh, she just got all her sadness all over me.
Okay, so bring me up to speed on the Bad Moms films here. So there's Bad Moms, and then there's a sequel, right?
Yes, Bad Moms are back. This is Mila Kunis, Kristen Bell, and Katherine Hahn reuniting for a sequel called Bad Moms Christmas. So as you might expect, it's going to be a holiday film due out in November. This time, the Bad Moms' own moms sign on. So Cheryl Hines, Christine Baranski, and Susan Sarandon play the moms of the moms. So Susan Sarandon was spotted up the other night at Bistro Nico, a very popular spot for visiting celebrities. They've been filming in the Buckhead area, so maybe you've seen Christmas decorations and thought, man, can we really get a handle on the early Christmas decorating? But no, that was for a movie set.
Robert De Niro is back to make a film here in Georgia, as is The Rock, right?
Yes, they're not moving. They're not making a movie together, but that may just happen. You see sorts of collaborations. Dwayne The Rock Johnson back again. He starred, of course, in Baywatch and a couple of the Fast and Furious movies. I think 5, 7, and 8 were filmed here. Now he's filming Rampage, which this is based on a classic 1980s video game featuring monsters that destroy cities. So, man, that sounds great. Robert De Niro is back. He has been here in the past for Last Vegas and then Dirty Grandpa, which was just terrible.
Right.
But higher hopes for this one. This is called The War with Grandpa. It sounds a little bit more PG-rated. He teams up with Uma Thurman, Cheech Marin, and Oaks Fegley, who was Pete in Pete's Dragon. This is a kind of a more family-oriented film about, you know, Grandpa moves into the family house and the kid doesn't want to give up his bedroom, so he and Grandpa engage in a war of wills, and I'm just going to guess it's going to have a happy ending. No spoilers.
So Jennifer, how do you explain the explosion? And I know people ask you this all the time, so I'm going to ask you.
Yes.
So how do you explain the explosion in movie television production here in Georgia? I know it has everything to do with this tax credit, but explain that in a way that makes sense to all of us.
Okay. In 2008, the Georgia legislature enacted this really hefty tax policy. So when a movie films here, they can either realize an up to 30% tax rebate when, you know, after they're done.
So on a $100 million movie, I can make it in Georgia for
whatever 30% less.
Yeah,
than.
Yeah. 30% of that.
Yeah, that starts adding up to real money after a while. So, for example, Anchorman 2, this filmed a couple years ago in Atlanta, not only were they able to reunite, you know, Will Ferrell, Steve Carell, all the usual suspects, they were able to just stock that movie like a Christmas goose with cameos. You had Kanye West, Jim Carrey, John C. Reilly, Tina Fey, Amy Poehler, Sacha Baron Cohen. I'm running out of breath here. For that last film, that last scene in Woodruff Park. And it was kind of like, look how much money we saved, and therefore we can, like, hire all these
people.
Take
30% off the top.
Yep.
Wow. And is it becoming a go-to destination for smaller films? Because the films we've been talking about have been huge films, right?
Yes.
And hundreds of millions of dollars to make these
films. Yeah, blockbusters. In fact, a film study recently declared that Georgia was the top filming destination in 2016 for the highest-grossing 100 domestic films, besting California, the UK, and Canada. But yeah, the smaller productions, they can actually get off the ground thanks to these tax credits. What you can do is, if you qualify, you can actually take your tax credits and say some, you know, wealthy business person wants to save some money off his expected tax return. He can actually purchase your tax credits for maybe 75 cents on the dollar, say. And you've got cash in your pocket. He's, you know, going to save money on his taxes. And then, you know, everybody gets to work on the movie. And in fact, there are wealth management experts who kind of have a subsidiary of their business, you know, connecting these folks, you know, production companies who want to, you know, have some cash to move forward with immediately, and then folks who are looking for a tax credit.
Has that, when I hear tax credits, I think, I'm not the only one, I'm sure, who thinks, boy, here comes another giveaway. Has there been much criticism of the tax credits to incentivize filmmakers to come to Georgia as a giveaway?
It does have its detractors, and every once in a while you'll see a study pondering, like, well, you know, is this really a good use of taxpayer dollars? Because we are basically giving, you know, tax giveaways to the richest people in the world, right? Hollywood, you know, celebrities.
Yeah.
So does that make sense? Georgia Governor Nathan Deal very emphatically has said yes. He and House Speaker David Ralston got together, as they usually do during the session, for Georgia Film Day, which, you know, highlighted all the movies that are made here. They did something really smart this year. They did interviews with folks like carpenters, electricians, you know, these sort of, you know, behind the scenes folks.
Yeah.
Really highlighting how many Georgians the film industry puts to work. According to the State Department of Economic Development, Georgia lensed productions generated an economic impact of more than $7 billion with a B.
$7 billion
during fiscal year 2016. And that the Motion Picture Association of America indicates that the film and television industry is responsible for more than 85,000 jobs in Georgia.
She's got facts and everything. Jennifer, great to have you on the program again. Jennifer Brett is with the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Jennifer, thanks.
See you soon.
And just ahead, we add another two songs to our Essential Georgia playlist. But first, why does Georgia rank so low for senior health? This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Tony Harris. June is Elder Abuse Awareness Month. The recently published America's Health Rankings Senior Report puts Georgia 41st in the nation for its quality of senior health. That's two slots lower than last year. So two things to talk about here with our guest this morning: the general health of seniors in Georgia and the issue of elder abuse. Kathy Floyd is here. She is the executive director for the Georgia Council on Aging. And Glenn Oster is on the line with us. Glenn is the director of the Institute of Gerontology at the University of Georgia. Good morning to both of you, Glenn and to Kathy. Thank you both for being here.
Good morning. Thanks for including me.
I'm really looking forward to the conversation. I want to first get to this issue of elder abuse and why it continues to be a problem that persists. We took this up with Robert Bush. He is a senior staff attorney for Georgia Legal Services in Savannah. He works on civil cases, including many with the elderly at the center of those cases. Here he is talking about the problem of elder abuse in Georgia.
I think the issue persists, again, because, you know, you have people who are out there who have no compunction about taking advantage of individuals who you can't take care of and can't defend and sometimes can't do some basic transactions for themselves.
Hmm. Glenn, you say Georgia is bad when it comes to community and environment engagement. How does that lack of engagement factor into elder abuse?
Well, I think it's everything is connected. So, yes, there's lack of engagement at the community level, and that is perhaps a process from both the top down and bottom up. The top down meaning what can our institutions, governments, and so forth do to better regulate the industry and make sure that there are qualified people who are well-educated, who understand their position and their role in looking after elders. But it also, from the bottom up, so to speak, on the individual level and the family level, is there's an education and awareness that needs to be put in place so people understand the dynamics of when your loved one is in a, whether it's an assisted living facility or a nursing home, that there are certain things that take place, and that if both sides are better educated, again, from the top down and bottom up, on what really is important to both sides in providing really good quality of care, and have sort of a meeting of the minds of both sides and saying this is, you know, having some metrics in place and standardizations on trying to improve the care so everyone benefits, both the employer, the employee, and also the person, the consumer, receiving the benefits of that care.
Kathy, what, from your perspective, is the problem with the quality of care for seniors in Georgia?
Well, you have, with our rankings, you do have a low ranking for nursing home quality, and that is definitely an issue in Georgia. But part of the reason for that is that we have one of the lowest Medicaid reimbursement rates in the country. Almost 80% of nursing home beds are paid for with Medicaid. And so when you pay less, you get less. And so one of the things that we need to do, frankly, is increase that reimbursement rate and tie it to quality. And one of the things that we're looking at is having the direct care workers, those folks that do the majority of the hands-on work, paid at least $10 an hour. And we think that is a possible way to get at some of these problems.
Well, you also say that seniors have not really been a focus of lawmakers. I know that's something that you're working on. And Robert Bush points that out as well. He agrees with you on this point.
Well, we have an elder abuse prosecutor here in Savannah, and I think there are others across the state. However, that is not in every county. The critical support that is required to develop a case, in many cases, financial forensic investigators often are not funded.
Kathy, what does it look like if lawmakers are more engaged on this?
Well, we have seen a difference in just the last couple of years. This year in the legislature, they funded the creation of a position for a statewide prosecutor. And this will get at something that Robert is talking about, because you have different counties that are you know, able to do different things. Frankly, here in the metro area, Cobb County is excellent. They do a great job. But a smaller county doesn't have the resources. So this statewide prosecutor will be able to go into different counties and be able to help them prosecute the wrongdoers. And that you know, that's a win-win. One of the things we're looking at doing is asking all of the major candidates for governor next year to make senior issues a priority. And I think with the numbers that we're looking at and the increases in the numbers of seniors and the numbers that are facing elder abuse and problems with hunger, problems with home care, staying independent, I think that that will be a win-win.
You know, Glenn, I want to get back to this question of education. You know, we should all be so lucky to live long enough to you know, live a life where we have great care around us as we age. What is it that we need to know as we age, and what do our family members need to know in terms of making sure that that great quality of care is available?
Well, I think there, a part of education is an awareness of the various factors. And both, when I say factors, I mean awareness and education, both formal and informal education, of those factors that will diminish our quality of life, but also looking at factors and having people have this awareness of what can they do when they're younger to have sort of over a life course, so they hopefully ensure themselves or at least give themselves a greater opportunity to age well or to have that quality of life. So I think education is a major, major part of it.
Is that education, and again, Glenn, sorry to interrupt, but is that education readily available? I mean, is it easily accessible?
I would think not. And when I speak of education, that could be ongoing campaigns, you know, from the government level. It could be starting right in our classrooms and educating those in grade school and high school and university about the process of aging and aging well and some of the factors that they may encounter as they age or their as they see their parents age or grandparents age. And again, it doesn't necessarily have to be formal education, but some sort of campaign that people start understanding that these are the issues that will happen to me. And I think you have to make it personal. These are the issues that will happen to me or my family at some point. And to another point is this, that this really should be a priority, you know, because right now about 15% of the U.S. population is 65 or older.
Yeah, yeah.
Within a decade or two, that's going to be 20, 21, 22%. That's going to be a huge number of individuals who are going through different scenarios in their life that they didn't have when they were younger, you know, in terms of chronic conditions, perhaps lack of independence, cognitive issues,
right.
Caregiver issues. And so, again, having some sort of understanding, and I use the word education, or awareness that we need to invest resources, we need to have awareness of how to handle various situations
sure.
as they arise and become personal.
And Kathy, will you take on this question of food insecurity for seniors? It's shocking what's in the report, and it's shocking to hear you talk about food insecurity and the problem that it is for seniors here in Georgia.
It is. The report shows that nationally the increase is about 16% in the last year on this. And unfortunately, in Georgia, we're up 18% with food insecurity. And this is
does that mean, food insecurity?
Well, the definition of food insecurity is the percentage of seniors facing the threat of hunger. So you have seniors that are buying their prescription drugs and not buying food. You can hear this from folks that are, you know, not just poverty folks. And it is a, you know, an issue of nutrition, not only to give them nutrition, but also the health benefits. And there are a lot of health problems that come when you're not getting the correct nutrition. So it is a real issue. Now, the good news is that Georgia is having its second annual Senior Hunger Summit in September, September 28th and 29th. And this is an initiative of the Georgia Department of Human Services to bring together stakeholders. Mm-hmm. This is elected officials. This is advocates. This is the...
And when is that happening?
September 28th and 29th. It's going to be at the Marriott Century Center right here in Atlanta.
And there's more information available.
Yes,
on this?
On the Department of Community, the Department of Human Services website. You can also find it on our website.
Great.
Georgia Council on Aging.
Kathy, thank you so much. Kathy Floyd is the executive director of the Georgia Council on Aging. And you've also heard from Glenn Oster. He is Dr. Glenn Oster, director of the Institute of Gerontology at UGA. Thank you both for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now let's add two more songs to our Georgia playlist. For this, we ask people to pick the best songs from and about Georgia. The rules are pretty simple. All tunes must be written or performed by a Georgian. An artist can't pick one of their own songs. AFFest is this weekend, so all week we are featuring songs chosen by musicians performing at the festival. Today's selections are from Andrew Shepherd. He is the frontman for Athens band Roadkill Ghost Choir.
Hey, my name is Andrew Shepherd. I play in the band called Roadkill Ghost Choir. My first pick for the Georgia playlist is Two-Headed Boy Part 2 by Neutral Milk Hotel. It's just, man, that song, I mean, that whole record is heartbreaking and beautiful and just so heavy. That song in particular, it's just so sad, and there's like a sweetness to it though. It's easy to listen to, but it's also has those moments of just devastating imagery.
Blessed I please with those wings in your spine. Love to be with a brother of mine.
All these kind of lines that I wish I wrote, you know, God is a place you'll wait for the rest of your life. It's just heartbreaking stuff.
Struggle to find secret songs that you keep wrapped in boxes.
I like sad music. I'm drawn to it. And that song is, yeah, I think it's a beautiful song. And it's so great because there's not a lot going on musically. It's just, you know, pretty much him and a guitar, but his vocal and the way he delivers the lyrics themselves carry it and make it like something really special. It kind of shows you that if you believe in the songs and you have a clear picture of what you want to do, you don't need a big budget and you don't need really the technical ability to play your instrument. My second pick for the Georgia playlist is Crease by Thayer Serrano. Yeah, this song, it's really dark, really. I love, there's a lot of like heavy tom drum kind of stuff. And the guitar tones are always so great. How she performs and the sound of it all is just close to that spiritual kind of like, oh my God, like, oh, I feel it. You know, it's very dark, it's very pretty. It just kind of hits all the things that, you know, I really like about music, and especially her music. It's just the atmosphere of this track that I think kind of captured me. Sad music, for me, just makes it easier to navigate through the hard times rather than an obscenely happy song about the glory of being alive. You know, it's like, that has its place, for sure. But yeah, I identify with more of a downer of a tune, simply because that's the reality, I think, of being a human.
Thank you.
a lot of the bands that I listen to and friends with here, there seems to be that common thread of everyone's trying to push themselves as musicians and as artists and not try to be something that they're not. Everyone's here seems to embrace kind of like their roots of being from Georgia. There's always like, you know, that southern kind of twang that runs through, like it's like a little filter.
That's Andrew Shepherd of the Athens-based band Roadkill Ghost Choir. They perform at AthFest on the main stage this Friday at 7:30 p.m. Have a song you'd like to put on the Georgia playlist? We'd love to hear about it. You can give us a call at 404-500-9457 or tweet us at OST Talk to nominate a tune. You can find the entire Georgia playlist series along with all the great music segments we've done at gpbnews.org. And coming up next on the program, the legacy of Tupac lives on here in Atlanta. It's on Second Thought. Second Thought, I'm Tony Harris in for Celeste Headlee. Hip-hop legend Tupac Shakur would have turned 46 years old last Friday. A new film called All Eyes on Me hit theaters this past weekend celebrating his life. Tupac's mother, Afeni Shakur, was very active in Atlanta. She donated a collection of his works to Clark Atlanta University. The archives include handwritten manuscripts, writings from his diary, song lyrics, and other personal items. With me now is hip-hop scholar Nsenga Burton. Nsenga, good to see you. Good
to
have you here.
Thank you for having me. Good to see you, too.
I have had the most wonderful conversations about Tupac, and I've got to admit this right off the top. I was Biggie. I was more Biggie than Tupac, right?
Yes.
Even though I'm a Baltimore kid, right? And Tupac spent time, you too?
10 years. I
in
lived
Baltimore?
In Baltimore, yes.
Okay, so when you think about Tupac Shakur, what comes to mind?
It's funny that you say Baltimore because that's actually the first thing I think about because he really is iconic there for a lot of different reasons than he's iconic for the rest of the country and the world, I would argue. Tupac is remembered in Baltimore as being very much of a layered individual. You know, he went to the very prestigious and illustrious Baltimore School of Performing Arts, right? And so everybody knows that that's one of the toughest art schools to get into on the East Coast and probably in the country. And they're very selective. And so the fact that he actually went there, he was at admitted there and that he had to engage in their not only creative curriculum, but also their academic curriculum.
Right.
People have a different kind of idea or way of seeing and thinking about Tupac in that from that perspective. But I think that his persona, you know, when he came out of prison, Clinton Correctional Facility, the persona that he adopted, because I never really believed that.
A persona that he adopted?
Yeah, I never believed that was Tupac. I mean, I just did not, based on all of the things I had known about him. I only met him once. I didn't have a real conversation with him. I was just in the same space with him.
So who was, because this is a central question, the mystery of Tupac, who he really was.
Well, and that's what this movie offers, right? And this is what this collection offers. Right. So you have this movie, which is Benny Boom and, you know, a bunch of other folks, their perspectives of who Tupac is. And then you have the late, great Afeni Shakur, who's the mother of Tupac, also an intellectual, political activist and what have you, and her perspective of who her son is.
Right.
The real Tupac. And so she has taken the time or took the time to, like, you know, carefully and methodically go through his materials for 2 years with an archivist at Clark Atlanta University in order to figure out how and what they want people to know about Tupac, like who is Tupac. And so out of this comes these letters.
But is it their vision of who Tupac was, or is it, can we think of it as the real version of Tupac? How are we to think about the materials?
Well, I think that because Afeni Shakur is his mother, and I'm a mother, right? So I feel like no one can tell me about my daughter other than me, right?
Good, bad, and otherwise.
Good, bad, and otherwise. Like, so all the stuff you're going to tell me about her, she's a baby, she's 19 months, but all the stuff you're going to tell me about her, even in daycare, I already know.
Yes, yes, yes.
No, but having said that, Afeni Shakur you know, the mother-son bond is an important one. A lot of times people focus on the father-son bond, the mother-daughter bond. But the mother-son bond, especially in the Black community, when many of our households are led by Black women, is a very important bond that people share. And so in this particular collection, the fact that she actually took the time to go through his materials and include, you know, treatments for music videos. She has the notebooks that he wrote All Eyes on Me and Tupacalypse Now in. She included a card, you know, her last card to him on his 25th birthday. That she wrote to him that has like a, you know, just the sweetest note in it. So, you know, she, I think, you know, there are different versions of Tupac. There are many layers to his lives. But if you want to see, you know, who he was as a son, if you want to see who he was as an artist, if you want to see who he was as an icon and right. as a leader in the community, then you want to see this collection.
So, and Zenga, I want to play a clip from the movie. And
okay.
And it touches on some of the complications in that relationship.
Yeah.
Let's roll the clip and let's talk about it.
Okay.
Like all Black leaders, you have a bullseye on your back, and today it just got bigger.
But I ain't no Black leader. Not yet.
And how you not a Black leader? The vice president was just talking about you on the TV. Baby, you have to understand. With the Panthers, it wasn't that we had guns or Black leather. It was because of our message. We were transforming minds.
And look, Effendi was a member of the Panthers. You know, she and 21 other members of the Panthers stood trial
yes.
in New York, accused
yes.
of what we would call today domestic terrorism.
Yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Did she see her son as a Black leader? And did Tupac ever come to see himself as a Black leader?
Yeah, I think the film actually does a great job of capturing that. I saw the film yesterday at the premiere in Atlanta, and it does do a great job of how she saw him relative to how he saw himself. I think it took time for him to realize that was his role. He's kind of his inherited identity, right? So kids develop identities in line with their parents and separate from their parents, right? So when you're trying to figure out who you are and where you want to be in the world, it may be completely in line with your parents, and it may be completely oppositional to
yeah.
what your parents want you to be. And so, yeah, she absolutely thought that it was every Black man and woman's responsibility to be some type of leader in the community, because our community was in such a state, particularly at the time period, if you're talking about the 60s and the 70s and the 80s, you know, you're going from post-industrial economics in most of the major cities. You're having uprisings. Where, you know, this is post-assassination of King.
Yeah.
This is, you know, the post-industrial complex. You know, jobs are starting to go overseas. You've got Reaganomics coming in. So all of this, and then the introduction of crack to African-American communities. And so you have all of these things happening that are really destroying our community. And so her idea was that we should all be leaders, right? This is the Black Panther moniker.
Yeah.
Taking responsibility for yourself, self-identity, self-determination. And she thought Tupac should do that. And as a man, and as brilliant as he was, he should be using his talents in that way.
Yeah. I want to play another clip from the movie. There's a bunch of sound that I want to get to as we talk mm-hmm. about the life of Tupac Shakur. This is another clip for the movie.
The man I knew wanted to use his voice to educate, to bring people together.
If he coming at me, he gonna get dealt with.
So can't nobody tell you nothing, huh? Huh?
Not about this.
If he's coming at me, he's gonna get dealt with. And that brings to mind the illusions of the phraseology, thug life.
Yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Talk to us about Tupac's embrace of thug life. It was tattooed on his belly.
Mm-hmm.
What did that mean for him?
Well, it was actually an acronym, and I think that he was trying to be subversive in using it, right? But what happened is that people weren't ready for that subversion, right? Part of how subversiveness works, or part of the way that being subversive works, is people have to be kind of in on the information that you are kind of deconstructing.
Yeah.
Right. And so because he's part of rap, because he's now on death row, people are immediately going to, oh, he's embracing being a thug, a criminal, a hoodlum, a gangster, when really what he was doing was kind of highlighting the complexities again,
right?
Of, you know, our identities. You know, there he is, the intellectual. He does quote Shakespeare. He does do ballet. But he also, you know, does rap. He does hip hop. And it's not separate necessarily. It all kind of lives together.
What do you criticize in Tupac's life?
I think Tupac there's room for criticism with Tupac, of course.
Oh, there's plenty of room for criticism with Tupac.
And his misogynistic lyrics, the way that he appeared to treat women. I think there's room for criticism in that
he spent time in prison for sexual abuse.
That he spent time in prison for sexual abuse. I think there's lots of room for critique about Tupac in a myriad of ways. You know, how he spent his money. And he was doing things to help the community kind of quietly. And it's kind of the way that Prince did, right? He was doing things that we didn't know about. So what we saw was all of this kind of, you know, glamorization of excess. You know, we saw a lot of that. So I think that there's room for criticism in terms of how he did use that platform and the fact that he did have that intellectual piece. He had the activist piece. And even though it was part of it's really part of his identity, the part that was most exposed was the kind of nefarious part.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that he had more control over that. Like, he was smarter than that.
Yeah, I want to play a clip. This is from Tupac. We should hear his own voice.
Yeah, absolutely.
This is from an interview with BET.
I trip off because it happens out of nothing. It just goes, you know, everybody just be screaming and acting. And I just trip. I get uncomfortable. And it's like similar to a deer being caught in the headlights. I just freeze, you know, and I don't know what to do. I don't know if I should be what they want me to be or if I should make them hate me so they can stop, you know, like say something mean so they can just stop. But I'm just like caught in the middle of it because, I mean, no one can do that. Police can't do that. They can't stand in front of all those people and control them with a gun and mace and all that. So me with just words, it's like a battle to find the right words to say at the right time.
So what does that clip say to you? It sounds like a bit of the complication and the conflict in his own life and in his own mind about how to present himself and the meaning of his message.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's very aware of the power of words. You can tell that in this clip. And he's very aware of how words can be used against you when the intention is different. Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, the basic communication model is not what you say or how you say it, it's how it's received. Right. That's just basic communication. And so I don't think he really had an academic knowledge of that, but he was experiencing that real world. Right. So with Thug Life, again, you know, most people are thinking, oh, he's glamorizing being a thug. But if you actually talk to him and sit down and have a conversation with him about it, you find out that he's actually deconstructing what it means and trying to throw light or shed light on the complexities that live within us.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
what's the relevance today? I'm thinking about people all over the state of Georgia who are listening to us right now and maybe asking themselves, what's the relevance of a Tupac? Why are we talking about, you know, a guy who claimed thug life, right? What's the relevance of Tupac in his life and his message today, you think?
Well, he's going to be relevant forever because Tupac really, at a young age, people forget that he died at 25.
Yes.
So he had all of these accomplishments before he was the age of 25, right? But he's relevant because he speaks to what is happening to people in the streets. You know, that hasn't changed. The conditions, and we're seeing that, you know. And so I think Tupac is relevant in terms of his lyrics, some of the things that he talked about, whether it was social justice, police brutality, people taking control of themselves and determining where they want to be and who they want to be and how they want to get there, not being a slave to dominant ideologies about race or, I will add now, gender, sexuality, but just not being a slave to what the dominant society of the ruling class says that you should be a slave to. So Tupac's always going to be relevant in that regard. And he's always going to be relevant, too, because, you know, he was a brilliant rapper. People forget that part about Tupac. He was absolutely brilliant. The whole Biggie-Tupac thing, you know, there's Biggie, there's Tupac, and then there's everybody else, you know. It's true, including Jay-Z, I know. And yes, and including the fabulous rappers you have in Atlanta.
Yes.
Love all of you guys, you know, all of you.
Right.
All of you are fabulous.
Oh, stop.
Biggie and Tupac,
yes.
And then there's everyone else.
And Zenka Burton is with us. She's a hip-hop scholar. I've got to ask you, what's on the essential, if you want to understand Tupac better through his music, give me three or four songs that are essentially Tupac.
The entire album, All Eyes on Me.
Hmm.
The entire album.
His biggest seller.
The biggest seller. Every
9 song. Million copies or so.
Yes, every song on there. Brenda's Got a Baby, if you really want to know the kind of the different layers of Tupac. I think I Get Around, which is a party song. You know, what people don't understand about hip hop is that you don't have to live in different camps. Like in our minds, outsiders, we think that you have to be in a different camp. You're conscious rap, you're party rap, you're whatever. But most rappers live in all of those different worlds and their music reflects.
How did it get so out of hand? How did this East Coast, West Coast thing, this Biggie Tupac thing get so out of hand? Now both of them are gone.
Well, the academic in me thinks it was orchestrated by the media companies and the record companies.
Really?
Yes.
Give me a line or two on that. What's your argument there?
I think that media, and I'm a media scholar and a member of the media, right? So I say this
As someone who works within the system.
Yeah, yeah. But I think sometimes you can help or hurt a situation. And I think all of the headlines, when all of the back and forth, and I mean, you know, Tupac has one of the most vicious diss records in history.
Hit him up.
I mean, it's vicious. You know, it's just vicious. And it's probably one of the best diss records out of all diss records. But I think that you can either be helpful or harmful. And I think it did not help to have all of these major, because this is at the height of hip hop magazines, too. I mean, everybody from Rap Pages to Vibe to The Source. This is the height of hip hop, you know, media. And so it does not help when you have these publications, including Rolling Stone, right, and the other iconic music publications really hyping up and talking about these things and feeding into the East Coast, West Coast, in addition to people who are, you know, young people. Hip-hop was a youth music, right? So you have people who are looking for their identities. They're looking for where they belong. And then you have gang culture that's running rampant in the country. Mm-hmm. Like, it just was not a good look. So I think that that's what happened. It was just a series of horrible incidents that came together at the same time and just led to the demise of two brilliant rappers.
And the significance, good, bad, indifferent, of Death Row Records, Suge Knight?
Yeah, I mean, Dre was on Death Row. You know, I mean, say what you will, but Death Row, I mean, they are definitively one of the most productive, creative, and successful rap music labels, I mean, you could say ever. And the talent that came out of Death Row. And so Suge was a lot of things, but he was also able to recognize talent.
Yeah.
But
that record label was tied to kind of a gang culture, correct?
Yeah, but that's not the first time. That's not just hip-hop.
Exactly.
The music industry is tied to crime.
But Tupac wasn't about gang life, was he? His life wasn't about the gangs.
Well, that's what that leads me back to what I started with when I said he was performing, right? Just like we have this political theater that we're watching in Congress now, same idea. I felt like Tupac was performing.
He assumed an identity?
He was performing that identity because he had to survive. You know, you have to remember he joined Death Row in order to get out of the Clinton Correctional Facility. He, you know, he went to jail and saw what it was and was like, oh, I can't stay here. And no one else was able to afford or would bail him out.
Right.
And so Suge came and got him. And so he had to really adopt that identity because that was the brand persona of that company.
And Zynga, how do you remember him?
I remember Tupac as brilliant, political, talented, and thoughtful. If you look at this stuff in this collection, I'm telling you, it ends on June 30th. Please, 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 if you can, see this collection. You see so many different layers, and you realize just how brilliant he was and that he really made a decision. And that's what happens with artists in general. They have to decide who they want to be to the public.
Yeah.
He made a decision.
Nzinga, good to have you on the program.
Thank you.
Nzinga
Burton. Thank you for having me.
Has been our guest. Yeah, real pleasure.
Yes.
And that's it for today's show, but we want to hear from you. You can reach us at facebook.com/onsecondthoughtradio or tweet us at OST Talk. And you can even leave us a message. And yes, we will listen to your messages. Our number is 404-500-9457. That's 404-500-9457. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Tony Harrison for Celeste Headley. Have a great day. Always was committed, a poor single mother on welfare. Tell me how you did it. There's no way.